Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. Today I have scheduled to speak with here David Enstone-Brewer, a biblical scholar from Cambridge, and we are going to be talking about his book, The Jesus Scandals. I'm hoping this is him on the line. Hello, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, I hope you're going to be able to stay with us for quite a while today.
Yep, it's 8 o'clock at my time here in the UK, and I'm here for the evening.
Okay, well, I hope we'll have a lot of fun here today. A lot of my listeners might not know about you right now. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Like, for instance, have you always been a Christian, or how did that come about? Just a brief bio of who you are.
I became a Christian around about the age of 12. I'd always been sent to Sunday school by my mother, but it sort of finally kicked in about 12 when I realized that there wasn't anything else I wanted to do apart from follow Jesus. But now I've gone into the ministry and then on into the academic world, and now I get paid for the best job in the world. I get to study the Bible and play with software.
Sounds like a dream position here. Now, another question I usually like to ask my guests is why my listeners should pay attention to them, which is essentially, what are your educational credentials for our audience so they can know where you're coming from?
Okay, well, I've got a PhD from Cambridge University, which means that most people say, okay, you must have learned something to get there. My research was in the rabbinic background of the New Testament, and I work in Cambridge at a research institute in biblical studies. So I'm mixing all the time with people who are working beyond the doctoral level in biblical studies, and it's a great place to work. You meet everyone.
Okay, now when you say your background's rabbinic studies, what you're pretty much kind of saying is that you work with items like, say, the Dead Sea Scrolls and other Jewish writings to see how they reflect Christianity, or the impact they have on Christianity.
My original plan was, when I went to study at Cambridge, was to see how the Jews in the time of Jesus interpreted the Old Testament, and I found that I was going to compare that with the way in which the New Testament studies the Old Testament, but I found that no one had done that work from the Jewish side, so I ended up being an expert on how the Jews interpret the Old Testament per se, and now I work particularly in the background of the New Testament from the Jewish point of view, yes, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, but also in the rabbinic materials, the Mishnah, Tosefta, the Talmud, things like that.
Okay, well, I'm certainly thankful that you came here today, and today we're going to be talking about your book, The Jesus Scandals. So tell my audience a little bit what the book is. What's the premise of the book?
Well, Jesus was a big shock to the system when he came onto the earth. He was born illegitimately. He grew up in a backward area of the country. He started preaching things that no one could accept. He had disreputable friends. He was accused of all sorts of things. And his death and resurrection were just as scandalous as the rest of his life. So the whole of his life was scandalous. But my particular interest in this as a historian is that the scandals in Jesus' life are the things that the gospel writers would not want to make up. So you can be more certain about them as historical truth than anything else.
Okay, now before looking at that, I'd like to contrast you, because I'm sure some people listening here are on the non-believer side, and I know you've debated Robert Price before, who holds to the kind of Christ myth. You know, you say Jesus was a big shock when he showed up, which means for the people who are around who knows him, he said things that were absolutely shocking, but at the same time, the way he went about his work and things that were so scandalous about him, most of the rest of the world probably wouldn't pay attention or wouldn't care. So when we hear like that so few of his contemporaries wrote about Jesus, the answer would be, well, of course, they wouldn't really care about him because of all the scandal and of where he was and things like that. Is that, would you agree with that?
Well, they wouldn't write about him because he wasn't interesting in terms of history. He was a preacher in a backward country who was talking about religious stuff. He wasn't killing anyone. He wasn't trying to get rich. So why on earth would historians write about him until suddenly the earth is full of people who are following him?
Yeah. Okay, now, something else about this book also is that the chapters are really short. And I gather that you did that in a way that you can, for instance, have a coffee shop conversation with someone, or a church group can get together and discuss the book very easily, chapter by chapter. Is that correct?
I was thinking more coffee of, you drink a cup of coffee, and by the time you've drunk it, you've finished the chapter. Yeah, they're coffee-length chapters, in that they were, a lot of them were written for magazine articles, and I suddenly realized this is a very good format to write, because usually you're reading something when you're on the tube or on a train. You don't have long to read it, or you've just got 5 minutes. And this gives, in 5 minutes, something worth reading and something worth thinking about. And, hey, you can't help talk about it because these things are gripping to you.
Now, you've said these were written as magazine articles at the start, so I found this too, that I think this book would definitely work well for people on the lay level. It's not written for the heavy scholar and such. It's written by anyone can pick it up and understand it.
Yep, but the heavy scholars as well, they find it fascinating because it summarizes stuff which they're all interested in. And virtually every chapter says something from an angle they hadn't thought of. So it's interesting for a scholar, but it's aimed at the ordinary person who wants to find out the real story behind the Gospels.
Okay. Now, you've said that these are the things that are scandalous, and therefore, it's kind of thing the Gospel writers would avoid. And since I mentioned it, that makes it more likely to be historical. And this is what's usually called as a criterion of embarrassment. So, would you care to explain how the criterion of embarrassment then works with your book?
Yep, absolutely. It's what the scholars call the criterion of embarrassment. That is, when you're writing something, you're writing the history of something. Say you're writing the history of Margaret Thatcher, who we've just buried. You, if you're a fan of Margaret Thatcher, you just say the nice things about her. And if you're an enemy of Margaret Thatcher, you just say the nasty things. And if you're saying something which goes against the case you're trying to make, you can be pretty certain that that's right, because otherwise you wouldn't have mentioned it. You're mentioning it just to make sure that the reader knows that you're telling the truth about the stuff that the reader might not agree with. So in the Gospels, when people accuse Jesus of being an alcohol abuser, or they accuse him of being of illegitimate birth, you can be sure that there were people who were accusing him of this, because otherwise the Gospel writers wouldn't mention it. You know, they'd avoid it if they could.
Now, just in case... Go on.
There are other things which we wouldn't expect to be embarrassing, like the number of miracles which are attributed to Jesus. That was a great embarrassment in the first century, because they were more skeptical about such things than we even are in the 21st century. And the resurrection, of course, is just beyond the pale.
Okay, I plan on discussing each of those sometime in the show as well. Before we get that, just be clear also, this isn't just some sort of criterion that conservative Christian New Testament scholars have made up. This is something that'd be accepted across the board pretty much by scholars of all persuasion, conservative, liberal, Christian, atheist, etc.
It's something that you use in history in general. You'd use it if you're trying to evaluate Josephus, a first century historian, or if you're trying to evaluate Winston Churchill. You use this criterion of embarrassment to work out, yep, that definitely must be right, or that's given more credence because it's embarrassing.
Okay, my guest is Dr. David Enstone Brewer. If you'd like to call in and ask him a question, the number is 714-242-5180. Now, let's get to one of the first scandals here, Vin, that you just mentioned, cars. Now, you said, for instance, that they were even more skeptical back then than we are in our 21st century, but mean, is this really the case? Because, you know, you meet so many people who say everyone back then, they were just gullible, they didn't know about the sciences, they'd buy into this stuff hook, line, and sinker. Are you telling me that they, even without the knowledge of modern science, these people were very skeptical of miracles?
Certainly. They're just as skeptical as anyone else nowadays. Not many people nowadays know about science, but they do know that your auntie doesn't get better just by herself. You know, broken legs don't heal, illnesses don't get better just by themselves, dead men don't rise. You don't need to be a scientist to know that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've always wanted to tell people when they say that we don't believe in suckers, we believe in modern science. I'm so tempted to ask, exactly which scientific experiment was done to demonstrate that dead people don't come back to life, and when was it done? And point out that the ancients did in fact bury their dead because they thought they weren't coming back. Can you cite any evidence that shows that the people were skeptical back then?
Well, the Jews, of course, did believe in a resurrection, and they did bury their dead. But, of course, the Romans didn't believe at all in resurrection. They burnt their dead. They didn't care about the body. Mm-hmm. It wasn't going to come back at all. And they thought it was so ridiculous that anyone would believe in resurrection. Well, you get an example in the Bible itself, in Acts 17, where Paul tries to talk about the resurrection. And these scholars that he's talking to in Acts 17 just laugh. You know, that they haven't heard anything so hilarious in front of them for a long time. The whole idea from the Greek and Roman point of view that someone would come back to life was just so stupid as to be, that you couldn't even address it. But in ordinary life as well, there are so many religious scams going on. You know, now we have scams going on by email and by through your bank and whatever, through the internet. But in those days, the big scams were religious scams. People made a new religion, made false miracles, and collected money, and then disappeared off into the night. And they were fun and very pervasive, and everyone knew about them. No one believed these miracles. And anyone who claimed to do miracles was obviously just a charlatan.
You say that the Jews were open to resurrection, and naturally, if the Old Testament, the Jews would be open to miracles, but you also say that Philo tried to avoid miracles when looking at the history of the Jews. So was there even some skepticism in Jewish circles about miracles?
Oh, certainly, yes. The Pharisees were not into miracles at all. Philo was a scholarly preacher. He tried to avoid talking about miracles, even in the Old Testament, where they were occurring. He would find allegorical ways of dealing with them. It was just not fashionable to talk about miracles or to take them seriously. So if you were a successful preacher, you just avoided the subject. And in the whole rabbinic world, there are just two people that we know who are celebrated for praying and for people to be healed. And they were very much outsiders, and so one of them was regarded as, almost a heretic. As Honi, he was regarded as a little bit odd. And Hanina, the other one, he was a very poor man, he was a very unimportant rabbi. People didn't do things with miracles.
Mm-hmm. And I've even read before that when the early church wanted to compare Jesus to someone who did miracles, they had to reach as far back to people like Pythagoras and Empedocles. There weren't modern claims going around.
Yeah, when they tried to say, well, you know, other great people did miracles, the Pythagorean stories about miracles are from many centuries back. No one gives them any credence. But the point is they had to try and grasp hold of someone that the Greeks respected that did miracles. It's very difficult to find anyone because in the Greek world you don't, you know, miracles are what charlatans do. So if the gospel writers were trying to sell Jesus, they would sell him like the church fathers did. When the church fathers talk about Jesus, they talk about his teaching, they talk about his ethics, they don't talk about his miracles because that's going to put people off. But the gospel writers, they're writing very close to the day. And if they don't mention his miracles and don't try and put some sort of positive spin onto the miracles and say, well, you know, look, people were actually helped by these miracles, people are going to say, yeah, but that Jesus you're talking about, he's supposed to do all these miracles, isn't he? So obviously he's a charlatan. But they can't avoid the subject. They've got to say, okay, he did do miracles. We put our hands up. We agree. But, you know, they were real.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But I can hear the skeptic in the audience saying, well, what about someone like Apollonius? Wasn't he supposed to do miracles? Weren't there ever Greek gods and such, you were supposed to do miracles.
The gods are allowed to do things. You know, they're up in heaven and they do silly things. They curse you. They treat you nicely one day. And yes, you've got this cult of the healing miracles of the Apollonius, and that sort of happens. But this is a man walking around supposedly doing miracles, and if he's doing that, it's a scam. Mm. That's what they would conclude. It's a scam. Mm. And so you try not to talk about religious leaders doing miracles, because it's like saying a religious leader is saying, "Give me all your money." Well, okay, yeah. That's not good. Well, in those days, the way to recognize that a religious leader is a nut and a charlatan is he's claiming to do miracles.
And I think we should also mention Lucian. He made a hobby, didn't he, of pointing out these fake claims.
Yeah, it's great fun. It's great reading. He talks about finding out how these miracles were done with a speaking tube into a statue, so that the statue appears to be talking, and the person who claims to have found a live serpent in an egg underneath the ground, underneath this ancient temple, and you know he says how it had been planted there before. Yeah, he went there and he did the scopes. He went and found the myths behind the stories and tried to expose everyone. And I think he did a good job, because these charlatans were taking lots of money and making fools of people. But the intelligent people, they weren't taken in by these scams. And they, you know, so it was a problem. What do you do? You've got to try to avoid saying Jesus did miracles, but you can't, because people remembered. But there were people walking around who'd been paralyzed. And they're walking around because Jesus touched them.
So you're saying kind of a climate back then would have been the same way we respond to televangelists today who claim all these miracles and say, and then please send in your faith donation of X thousand dollars and you'll be blessed for it.
Yeah, I'll send you a handkerchief that I've blessed and you'll be healed. That's it. I'm afraid we don't have them in the UK. It's a curse of America only.
Yeah, we apologize for that one. What you've been saying then is the gospel writers would have loved to avoid miracles, aside from maybe the resurrection. It was kind of essential they mentioned the resurrection. But they had to mention the miracles, not because it would support their cause, because they had to answer their critics who would be talking about the miracles.
Yeah, absolutely. They would have said, well, we remember that these people said they'd been healed. Well, that was your Jesus, wasn't it? That's a big mark against your Jesus. You know, how are you going to stand up for that? So they had to give some sort of positive spin on those miracles.
And interestingly, even our critical sources don't even deny that Jesus did miracles. For instance, Celsus says that Jesus learned how to do miracles, I think, in Egypt, where he learned dark arts, and the Talmud says that Jesus tried to lead Israel into sorcery. That's correct, isn't it?
Yep, in Talmud, that's Sanhedrin 43a, isn't it? Down in it's been censored out of the printed Talmud in the 15th century when, in order to get it printed, they took out all the references to Jesus. But you can see it in the Munich Talmud, the Munich manuscripts, which is there before the censorship. There's that reference to what Jesus was actually crucified for leading Israel astray, for misleading, but also for sorcery. And that sorcery is so interesting, because there were two crimes you could commit. You could commit magic or sorcery. Magic is where you sort of do a magic trick and everyone knows it's just a trick. And sorcery is where you're doing real stuff. There's this nice debate between two rabbis working out whether someone's doing sorcery or magic. He said, in the marketplace, I saw this guy. He chopped a camel in half and then said some magic words, and the camel came back together again, and there was a living camel again. And the other rabbi goes, yes, but was there any feces on the ground? Was there any blood? Was there any smell? If there wasn't, it was just magic. That's okay. But if it's sorcery, it's done by the power of the devil, and that's a capital crime. And Jesus was accused of sorcery. In other words, real stuff happened. The rabbi said it was real, and therefore he deserved to die. So that by charging him with sorcery, they're saying, yes, these miracles are real, but they're done by the devil.
So when the Pharisees charged Jesus with casting out demons by the power of Beelzebub in Matthew 12, they're actually charging him with sorcery.
Well, yeah, casting out demons was not so bad, but that's not doing sorcery. You know, it's not doing real acts. It's getting rid of demons. But they were saying, yes, you're on the side of the devil there. But when they went to crucify him, they crucified him for sorcery, so that would be the miracles that they're crucifying him for.
Okay. Our guest is Dr. David Enstonbrewer. We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, I'd like to talk about the virgin birth some. Our call number, if you want to join in, is 714-242-5180. I'm Nick Peters, and we'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Hey, this is Minister Grok. Thanks for listening. Although Grok Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcasts, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at CYIWorldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we're back. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. We are talking with David Enstonbrewer about his book, The Jesus Scandals. If you want to join in, it's 714-242-5180. We've talked about miracles, but we have to hit as much as we can. I think the virgin birth would be something interesting. Now, I think a lot of modern Christians today, they read about the virgin birth, they think, the writers put this in so they could prove to us the deity of Christ. This was an important point they wanted to highlight. But, Dr. Enstonbrewer, you say that's not really the case, right?
Well, they had to do something with Jesus' birth because everyone knew that he'd been conceived illegitimately. They knew that you are born after 9 months, and they can count 9 months back from when Jesus was born, and they found that his parents were married a bit too late. You know, so something was wrong in the first place. And the gospel writers deal with this in different ways. You know, that Matthew and Luke, they say very clearly that he was conceived of the Holy Spirit, so this was something very, very strange. Mark doesn't mention anything, but, of course, in Mark, Jesus is called the son of Mary. This doesn't happen anywhere else in Jewish literature, that you're always called the son of your father's name. He's not called the son of Joseph, he's called the son of Mary. Very, very strange, and I've got to be pointing at the fact that there's something strange going on with the birth. And even in John, you've got this heckler who says, well, at least we know who our father is, you know, as if Jesus didn't know who his father was. Mm-hmm. So it's right through the Gospels. Everyone's talking about what is it about Jesus' birth? And the Gospels have got to say something.
Mm-hmm. And for virgin birth, it really would be something embarrassing to say. What would be exactly embarrassing about the virgin birth?
Well, it would be much better to say that, well, Jesus was born from Joseph, but, slightly out of wedlock. That was fine. But being born of the Holy Spirit, well, that's just blasphemy. It's to say that God got involved with a woman and therefore had a child is far more dangerous to put them out than to say that he had a shorter gestation, or that Joseph was just not quite married or something like that. If you don't do blasphemy that easily, you know, blasphemy is a crime that can't be forgiven. It's something that you're going to be killed for. You just don't play with that sort of thing. And to invent that story, you'd invent almost anything else but that story in order to deal with Jesus' strange birth.
Yeah, years of debating, you're an atheist, I know that. Usually someone would say, well, if your wife came to you and said, I'm pregnant and it's by the Holy Spirit, would you believe him? And the obvious answer is, no, of course not. And we know from before, neither did Joseph, and quite frankly, neither would anyone else.
Yes, it's not really a believable story, is it? It's a story that you would come up with in order to not be believed. But nowadays, it doesn't matter. You know, nowadays, you're just telling a fib. But then it's blasphemous, you know, and you're going to get killed if you're believed. So you're either going to be thrown out of court for telling a complete ridiculous lie, or they're going to believe you and stone you. You're in a lose-lose situation. It's the most ridiculous story you could invent.
So our idea of a Christmas story as being a nice, happy little story actually would reek of a scandal that would make the headlines today if it was going on.
Well, imagine a headline, God rapes a 12-year-old. And then you've kind of got the idea of how they're thinking. You know, there's just no good way of seeing this. There's no good way of portraying it. It's got to be bad all the way down the line. And to make it up, you've got to be a right idiot who just doesn't understand the people you're talking to.
And yet, everyone knew this charge would have been going around that Jesus was the Son of God in a much deeper sense than a lot of other people were, so they had to say, well, we can't really deny that. We have to put the virgin birth in there somehow.
Well, no, that's the whole point. Anything would do other than the virgin birth.
Yeah.
You know, so you're going around saying Jesus is Son of God. Well, why not just say that he was dropped out of the sky, or that something happened after he was born, he was infused with the Holy Spirit or something like that. But to say that God mated with a woman is just such a blasphemous thing to do. I just can't imagine anyone being so stupid as to make that up.
I just love the way you just tell it like it is. It's so great. And the other aspect of this that would be troubling is that this would just reek of paganism, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, the pagan gods, they did pagan things. And, of course, in Judaism, you also have this concept of the evil angels who came down and mated with women in Genesis 6. And that was the origin of the evil spirits. So that just shows how abhorrent that sort of idea was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that this is the worst thing that the devils ever did, that they mated with humans. And then to say that God did that, it's like saying, you know, God is worse than a demon. You don't do that. Not when you're trying to convert someone to follow that God.
Now, to be sure, though, when we do talk about the virgin birth, and there are a lot of people who misunderstand what's going on, such as Mormons and Muslims both, who take it that God literally had sex with Mary. And to clarify, the gospel writers aren't saying that, are they?
Well, who knows? I mean, what on earth is it? That's completely unprecedented. What's it mean that the Holy Spirit overshadows her or whatever? We've no idea what this is supposed to represent. And any description that's put onto it can only make it worse. You know, the mind boggles at what it could possibly represent. And the fact that your imagination goes like that just tells the person who started this, don't do it. And the only possible reason I can think that the gospel writers would mention something so abhorrent to every single one of their readers is, well, that was what happened. That's what they were told, and they didn't know any better version. There's no way they could spin this to make it any better. It was abhorrent, and they just chose to record it. John and Mark, I think, were sensible. They just didn't mention it.
And so, return to the claim about miracles, the critics of Jesus would have been mentioning his illegitimate birth. Today, in our society, we probably wouldn't mention that so much, but back then, your reputation also depended on your family, your genealogy, and who you came from. And if you were born illegitimately, that lowered your reputation, your honor. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. You know, you can live with illegitimate birth. It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing to bear in your life, and it means you can't marry because who's going to marry your daughter to you? But there certainly are worse things, and one worse thing is to say that God came down and mated with your mother.
Mm-hmm.
that's worse by such a huge degree that you run away from that and say, no, I'm just a bastard.
Mm-hmm. And so this charge of being illegitimate, it would have really followed Jesus, his whole ministry, wouldn't it?
Certainly, yes. You see it following him when that heckler, you know, who says, well, at least we know who our father is, when Jesus is trying to say, I am the son of the father. Everyone was talking about it behind his back, if not to his face, because it was an unusual thing. Not completely unknown, of course. You have this class of people within Judaism, the Manzarim, the people who didn't have a legitimate family line for 10 generations. And they were not allowed to take part in the normal religious observances in the synagogue, and certainly weren't allowed to go into the temple. And they couldn't marry a legitimate person, someone born legitimately. But Jesus wasn't a Manzer. He wasn't officially illegitimate, because it's such a difficult thing having these illegitimate people around who couldn't take part in the normal Jewish thing. The rabbis found ways to restrict the number of people who could be called a mamzer, could be called a bastard. So they said, well, you've got to have two witnesses of the conception. Yeah, I don't know where they're going to get two witnesses of a conception from. But anyway, they said that you've got to have two witnesses in order to declare someone illegitimate. So, of course, Jesus wasn't officially illegitimate, but everyone knew. And my guess is this is why he didn't marry, because he couldn't marry a mamzer. He wasn't an official mamzer. And he couldn't marry a normal Jewish girl, because no father would give his daughter to someone who had this hanging over him in his life.
Some reason I just started thinking about that story of the student who was under his rabbi's bed taking notes while the rabbi was with his wife, so he'd learn the proper way. You know about how they have to have two witnesses to the conception. Anyway, to get back to the story now, in the book you also say that there were a number of other theories going around about Jesus, such as the son of Pantera.
Yeah, well, you've got to try and explain it somehow, and one of the stories that went around, I think it's Celsus refers to it, doesn't he? But you find it in several places in the Talmud, that he was the son of this perhaps Roman Pantera. And certainly there are plenty of rapes by soldiers going on, and that would be a nice, easy explanation. And I'm sure that if the Gospel writers were inventing the story, they would have brought something, you know, they would have suggested something like that, but Mary had been raped, and Jesus was the result, and God stepped in and rewarded her faithfulness in making Jesus into a good religious teacher or something like that. And that would have been a nice story, and everyone would have been on his side. But instead, we have the story of God having sex with a woman, and that was a very hard sell.
And this would even work well with what we were just talking about, because not only do you have a case of America, you have America involving God doing something that God had never been known to do, except for maybe those wicked, evil pagan gods, which can be making God very human in what he did, which is kind of ironic with the incarnation. But everything about the virgin birth, despite what people would say today about how it was made for him to give glory to Jesus and to let people notice him and such, it was actually something that Matthew and Luke would have loved to have been able to leave out of their accounts.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, let's go ahead also and start with the next section. Thing is really interesting is the chapter Contemplating Suicide. Okay, what's Viz about?
We still have this same sort of shame that they had in those days. This suicide, I suppose, wasn't so shameful in those days. It's more now. But among Jews, it was, in the same way that we suffer it. Suicide was considered a sin because you're taking something which belongs to God and throwing it away. And although in the Roman world, you commit suicide just when you're bankrupt or when something shameful happens to you. In Jewish laws, you would never commit suicide. But in the Garden of Gethsemane, you have these very strange words that Jesus is saying, "I am sorrowful even unto death." And it's difficult to know what he meant by that, except that he wished he was dead. And that certainly is exactly what those words mean in Jonah, which uses exactly the same phrase. It's the only other place where that phrase occurs. Jonah wished he was dead. And so Jesus wasn't pretending to be human as he wandered through this world. He felt the full breadth of our emotions, and including the unwelcome emotions. But it's something we don't normally say because, you know, we concentrate on Jesus being the divine, but we have to remember he's also human. And yeah, it looks like he was feeling suicidal there in Gethsemane.
Okay, why do you think Jesus was that way? I mean, we can say, well, it's obvious he was going to the cross, but do you think it was the pain of the cross that was frightening him, or something else?
Well, just humanly speaking, it was a really frightening prospect to go to the most cruel form of execution ever invented and to walk there voluntarily. But also, he must have felt so forgotten by everyone. You know, he was surrounded by crowds to start with, then suddenly they were disappearing, and he knew that everyone was going to disappear the next day. And now he's just got his few disciples with him, and they're asleep. And then suddenly even God feels far away. Even God feels distant. And that's exactly how depression makes us feel, completely isolated from everyone, as if there's a concrete wall between us and everyone else and a concrete ceiling between us and God. Everyone is gone. You're on your own, and surely the world would be better off without you. And Jesus must have felt like that there was just no reason for him to be alive anymore.
And we could also add in that not only was he alone, he was about to have betrayal take place from Peter, the one who was pretty much his right-hand man, was going to be very soon saying, "Jesus who? Never heard of him."
Yeah, we don't know how much the human Jesus knew exactly what was going to happen in the future. Remember, when he's on Earth, he is a human, and our brains can only hold so much information. And presumably he didn't hold the information about what was going to happen in the future, so he wouldn't know exactly what was going to happen. And that, of course, increases the fear and increases the desperation of, you know, you're not sure exactly what's going to happen. But when Judas comes to him and kisses him in order to mark out who he is, that's the final slap in the face. It's, you know, this person is pretending friendship even at that moment. And of course, Jesus' life wasn't worthless. It just felt like it to him at that time. And yet his life at that point was the most valuable life on earth, because by going to the cross for us, he managed to buy life for all of us. But for the human Jesus at that point, he was going right through the depths and facing the ultimate temptation to take his own life.
And you mentioned Judas. You know, Judas gets a bad rap in the Gospels, and understandably so, of course, for betraying Jesus. But beforehand, no one would have thought Judas would do anything like that, because he was the money bag holder for the group, and the money bag holder would be one who would be seen as the most trustworthy one in the group.
Yeah, I guess it's the other way around. It's not that because he's got the money bag, therefore we trust him. Because we trust him, we give him the money bag. But perhaps he had a higher status than the others, you know, brought some money with him. You usually make the richest man in the church a treasurer, because he's less likely to steal the money and he's more likely to give more. But Judas probably had some sort of status in order to get that role. So yeah, from the outside, people probably thought Judas was the best disciple and turned out to be the worst.
Okay, we're here with Dr. David Enstone Brewer. We're going to take a brief break. When we're back, we're going to be discussing this matter further. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back in a little bit.
Hey, what up, y'all? This is your host, Suave Bill, on Hip Hop for Your Soul show. You could tune in every Friday night, 6 o'clock Western Time, 8 o'clock Eastern Time, on Grok Radio. And yo, if you missed the live show, that's okay, because it's on Wednesday nights, too, on TrueSwagRadio.com. Check it out, 8 o'clock on Wednesdays. If you missed all that, you can go on iTunes and type in Hip Hop for Your Soul show and put it on your iTunes dial and then listen to the podcast. You can also go on CYIWorldwide.com and check out all the archives, all the shows that we have on there. Peace.
I'm Nick Peters. We're back with the Deeper Waters podcast. I'll call in them. 714-242-5180. We are here with Dr. David Enstone Brewer discussing his book, The Jesus Scandals. Now, you said at that time when Jesus is in the garden that even God was distant. Could you elaborate on that some?
Well, of course, we think of God as being distant from him when he's on the cross, and that being as part of the suffering of the cross, and Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? But why did it start just at the cross? Why would God just be far from him at the cross? And I see no reason why it shouldn't also be there in the Garden of Gethsemane. And that was part of the sufferings he was going through as he's being tempted by the devil. You know, look, even God has left you, as if to say. Mm. And that's feeling of depression is, and that's a feeling, is part of that feeling of isolation that God has left him to his fate.
Yes, we realize that in our evangelical circles, there seems to be a tendency that we want to so emphasize the deity of Christ, and rightfully we should for all the cult groups and such out there, but it's just as important to Orthodoxy to emphasize the humanity of Christ, because if we have a Jesus who's just pure deity only, we don't have Christianity. And part of recognizing the humanity is that Jesus went through many of the same physical and emotional struggles that we go through every day.
Yeah, I mean, as it says in Hebrews, that we have a high priest who understands what we go through and doesn't just understand it. He's been there himself. He's suffered every temptation that we suffer. And in other words, he's got to suffer the depression, the suicidal tendencies that comes at such terrible, terrible temptation to people. Jesus had to suffer those too.
I'm not sure if you've seen the news from where, but for instance, a big headline a few weeks ago was Pastor Rick Warren, his own son, tragically committed suicide. It's a great tragedy. My wife and I were very sad about it, definitely included in our prayers, and it's a joy that so much of a world wrapped around him at that point. And I did notice on some blogs, some people would show up and they'd have nothing but negative comments then, and everyone was like, this is serious suffering that someone is going through. Now, of course, Jesus never committed suicide, but we could say he understood the way of the temptations of those who try to do so, and even understand what happens to those who succeed in doing so.
Yeah, it is sad that the church had to make such a strong stand against suicide that it said, well, if you commit suicide, you're not going to be buried in the church, and as if you know, that suicide is going to mar your future life as well, your life in heaven. Suicide is a terrible tragedy for the people who love you and for yourself when you do it, but it's not the unforgivable sin. It is something that the Romans did easily, and the church had to stand up against because they had to say, no, this is utterly wrong to throw away something that belongs to God. Your life belongs to God. It's been bought at a price, and you can't just throw it away.
Now, having Jesus be this way in the garden, that would have been scandalous to the Jews, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but you said the Romans, they took a different approach. But how would your average Greek or Roman have seen Jesus in the garden at this point?
Oh, it was, right for a Roman to commit suicide if they got into a terrible situation. So you've got many famous famous Greek and Roman suicides: Pythagoras, Socrates, Zeno, Demosthenes, and Nero, and also the emperors. They commit suicide. They're expected to commit suicide when they get to points of shame. But of course, it wouldn't really help Jesus very much in their eyes. It doesn't make Jesus look any better if he's committing suicide now, because he's just escaping his proper punishment. And you know, it's just a criminal getting away. It's a bit like Nero before he gets arrested. He decides to kill himself. Well, he couldn't go through with it, and he had to get a companion to show him how to do it by killing himself first. And these stories aren't to Nero's credit, they're to his shame. And I don't think that they would have regarded the fact that Jesus was tempted with suicide and didn't go through with it as a good thing. They would see that as just cowardice on Jesus' part. This story does nothing to help Jesus in Greek and Roman eyes.
Now, today, we Christians, we do see this as a sin. There's no condoning it, even though we can sometimes understand the circumstances. But the fact that our attitude might have changed some, that could actually be a direct result of Jesus' teachings, that we do want to have sympathy for those who are struggling this way, because we know Jesus himself struggled.
Well, the tragedy is that people even seem to regard the temptation to commit suicide as sinful. You know, as if the very fact that your mind is forcing you to think this way, you're doing something wrong by that, and that people who suffer from depression must be very sinful because, you know, if they're living a good life, they wouldn't suffer in this way. And that's one thing I love about this story of Jesus in Gethsemane. It shows that Jesus, absolutely perfect, having committed no sin at all, is still facing the same feelings that many of us face.
There was a time, I remember, when I struggled with panic attacks and anxiety, for instance, and I do remember that usually some of the worst trouble you can have with fellow Christians then is so many of them seem to be Job's friends, and they take on an idea of suffering that's from the oldest book in the Bible that God himself said was wrong, and they still use it today.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems strange when Jesus goes around saying, no, this person isn't ill because of his sin. No, this person isn't ill because of his parents' sin. No, this person's just ill. People don't listen. They still think, well, you know, you've got to be ill because you've done something wrong. Are you going to be ill because you're weak? Are you going to be ill because you're just stupid? No, you're ill because it's the fallen world. And Jesus came to try and deal with that and bring us into a new world.
And sometimes bad things happen. It's not because of us, but like the blind man, that if we are willing, every bad thing can be redeemed for the glory of God.
But, and also we have to say, not every blind man is going to be healed.
But
the worst thing you can say is, okay, you weren't healed because you didn't have enough faith. And you say, well, how much faith did that blind man have? That blind man didn't even know who Jesus was. He didn't find out Jesus was supposedly in the fire until after he'd been healed. So he didn't have any faith. Did his parents have faith? No, they were disowning him. They didn't have faith for him. Did his friends have faith for him? No, they didn't know anything about Jesus either. No one there had any faith that he would be healed. God did it.
Yeah, and when
someone
great
is healed, you can't blame their lack of faith.
A great example of that, I think, would be the son of a widow from Nain. I mean, most of them, when Jesus stopped the funeral procession, were like, okay, this is some crazy guy. How do we tell him he's crazy? But we can definitely be sure the dead guy didn't have any faith.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Now, we've been talking about what's in the garden, and that leads up to the crucifixion. The crucifixion would have been one of the most shameful things of all. But before we discuss how shameful it was, in our modern American society, we can have a hard time understanding how big a deal honor and shame was back then to the people. So can you give us a bit of a rundown about how honor and shame worked in both societies back then?
Yes, I can say it, but I can't feel it. I think in Mediterranean societies, there's still this sense of honor that your whole family is tainted by dishonor. You see it a little bit in the sort of Pakistan honor deaths, you know, when a daughter brings shame on a family, she's executed by the family. But the honor and is the most important thing you can own. We might think our Xbox or our car is the best thing that we own, but for Roman and to a large extent the Jews, their honor was the most valuable thing they had, and to lose that would be to lose everything.
So what exactly was their honor? It was pretty much just how you were seen by the populace as large, and is that correct?
No, it's not just a matter of being rich and therefore people look up to you. It's much more looking at people's virtues, looking at their lifestyle, looking at them as good people and respectable people. A Roman would be very aware of what virtues they had cultivated in their life and what vices they still had. You see that to a certain extent in New Testament literature. You have Paul and Peter talking about the virtues that Christians should be developing. But the Romans were very aware of the things that they could count as being successes in their life, not in terms of money, not in terms of owning land, but in terms of their own life and what they had done. And so that was, I think they're right to count that as valuable, right to count that honor as being important, and perhaps it's something we've missed, something we've lost.
Yeah, and would the closest parallel today be to say, for instance, someone's reputation?
I guess, yes. Reputation really means, do you think this person's a liar or not? But it was that sort of thing, but much more multiplied.
Yeah, and we can think back of the pagans back then. I think a lot of Christians might think of them as these people who were just living in sin constantly. But the Romans and the Greeks were very concerned about good living with regards to virtue. And that is something we've lost today, isn't it?
Yeah, of course, they had a different set of virtues. We concentrate on their terrible sexual immorality, and we think they're terrible people. But no, they were extremely virtuous people. You could be executed for being impious. You know, impiety was a very great crime. That's it, impiety towards the gods. And to cheat someone with money was a very terrible thing. But to have sex with your slave, well, that was just what you did.
Yeah, you mentioned impiety. That's exactly what's going on in the dialogue of Euthyphro and Plato, that someone's bringing a charge against their father, that their father is impious.
And that's a very important charge, yeah. So the execution of Jesus as just a petty criminal and the worst of criminals means that the whole of his family, not just him, and all his friends and all his associates would be tainted with this same criminality and this same absolute low life of society.
Okay. How would the whole of society have seen not just the crucifixion of Jesus, but crucifixion in general?
Well, crucifixion, you have to realize that crucifixion was abolished soon after because it was just too cruel. Even the Romans considered it too cruel. You could only crucify slaves. There were a few occasions when non-slaves were crucified, but it's very rare. Because the slaves are property and you could do what you liked with them. And you do it in order to absolutely horrify anyone else, so that they'll never do anything like this. But we would call it a barbaric way of executing someone. It's a way of putting absolute frighteners on other people as they see a person in extreme pain for such a long time.
And if I'm correct, some of the Roman writers, when they spoke about crucifixion, they wouldn't even use the word crucifixion because it was so horrible.
I'm afraid I don't know about that.
Okay.
I haven't read that.
Okay, that's what I've heard before then. We see some of this going on in 1 Corinthians 1, for instance, that when the Christians would go out and evangelize, like, We'd like to tell you about our new king, Jesus. Who is he? Well, he got crucified. Okay, end of story. That's all we want to hear. That's pretty much how it would have went, isn't it?
I guess it would have been, yes. It's a bad story to try and tell anywhere. Obviously, Greeks and Romans, if a person's been crucified, he was not only a criminal, he was the lowest of the criminals. He wasn't even worth knowing what he was accused of. But for Jews, of course, you have this extra burden that in Deuteronomy it says if you hang a corpse on a tree, then God curses that person. And so it means that Jesus was cursed by God, and that's what the Jews would have been saying. And so Paul has to do something with that, and he sort of puts a spin on it and says, well, yes, okay, this does mark that he was cursed by God. He was cursed by God on our behalf. So he bore our curse. But it was very difficult to get that argument across, and crucifixion was a very, very difficult thing to sell.
And interestingly, we have scholars like John Dominic Crossan, and I'm sure you agree with this quote, is that if there's any sure fact, I'm going to paraphrase, but it's pretty much, if there's any sure fact of history, it's that Jesus Christ was crucified. That aside from those on my fringe, such as the Christ mythos and such, no one in scholarship would deny Jesus was crucified.
Yeah, there's certainly no one in scholarship who would deny that. It is the ultimate of the embarrassing facts about Jesus. And the criterion of embarrassment can be used anywhere. It's there in the crucifixion. But the crucifixion doesn't make Jesus special. You know, we think that there hanging on the cross, we look up to that as it's such a special event for us because it released us from sin. But of course, there were many other people crucified. People were horrified when they saw the life of Brian, and there's Jesus crucified among other people, and you know, there's lots of people being crucified, as if to say Jesus' crucifixion didn't mean anything. Well, that's how it was. There were lots of people crucified, and when the temple was being destroyed and Jerusalem was surrounded, anyone who escaped was crucified, and 500 a day sometimes. This is something that's happened to many, many people. And it's only special with Jesus because he walked to that cross and volunteered. Mm-hmm. Other people's sentiments ran away.
Now, I think it was in your debate with Bob Price on Unbelievable that you pointed out that if someone was making up a story, they could make up a story of Jesus dying a painful death, which could have been seen as giving him honor, but no one would make up a story of him dying a shameful death.
Absolutely, because when you have the martyrs in Maccabees, you have these brothers who are being killed one by one before their mother and being asked to deny the Jewish faith. You have them, their skin is being torn off their bodies, and their limbs are being held over flames, and you know they're being tortured for a long time, painfully, but it's not shameful. It is an honorable way of being tortured, and that they die still confessing Judaism, and they die as heroes, and they are heroes in the Jewish faith. But for Jesus, he died this absolutely shameful way. And I've said in the book details about how shameful it was, things I can't say on the radio because you'd have to blank it out, things which you can't put in the Gospels because they could never be published. You can put it in print now because we have such a low level of publication. You know, you can say virtually anything. Mm. But I can't say it on the radio or TV or anything because you just can't say these things. What happens during a crucifixion? It is just utterly shameful.
And even today, I mean, there are some people who would say that, you know, a lot of people would want to go with the story of Jesus because of empathy and such. And the most you could probably give in the ancient world is, well, that's a nice story, but I'm not going to become a follower of Jesus, because first off, that's not even very likely to happen, and second, if you were a follower of Jesus, it would mean you were staking your whole identity on a man who was crucified. Is that correct?
You just wouldn't follow someone who is crucified. How do we put it nowadays? It's like saying he was executed by a multiple gang rape. You know, it's something that's so shameful, it completely wipes out anything great in their life, in their in their history and makes them into a story that you couldn't possibly tell to your friends. It wipes out everything from it. You can't talk about it.
I'm Nick Peters, and this is the Deeper Waters podcast. And we've just talked about the crucifixion, and we can be thankful the resurrection changed all of this, or did it? When we come back from our break, we'll be talking about the resurrection with Dr. David N. Stone Brewer.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
I'm back with David N. Stone Brewer out of Cambridge. We're discussing his book, The Jesus Scandal. Before we get into our next part, so I don't forget, Dr. N. Stone Brewer, if someone wants to get a copy of this book, how can they get a copy of it?
go to BibleScandals.com, and you've got the link there through to the normal Amazon things. And you can also read the beginning of every chapter and get an awful lot for free.
Okay.
BibleScandals.com.
All right. Now, we've been talking about the crucifixion, and we can be thankful that these charges would have been reversed in the resurrection, and the resurrection would have been a story everyone would have flocked to and wanted to accept immediately, would have been seen as good news to everyone. Or maybe not. You think that it would have been seen a bit differently, don't you?
Well, if you're trying to sell Christianity as a new religion, you wouldn't want it to end with this, because you get to the end of the story and you say, and he raised from the dead. And everyone goes, okay, right, it was a joke you're telling us. You're not really telling us about anything real. Okay, good one, good one. Yeah, right. Now let's move on. No one could take it seriously. The idea of resurrection, for Judaism, it's something that's happened perhaps in the past, but it wouldn't happen now. And for Jews and Romans, it was just too laughable to be serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, N.T. Wright, in his book, The Resurrection of the Son of God, says, the Greco-Roman culture was very clear about resurrection. It didn't happen. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and everyone knows that. You know, it's in the experience of every single person. When someone dies, they're dead. They don't come back to life. And, okay, so you say, well, Jesus was special. He came back to life. It would be much better if we're going to invent a story now. If we're going to be in the first century and say Jesus' death wasn't the end, he would come back as a spiritual being. He'd come back as an angel, you know, someone who sort of you could put your hands through, and then he'd say, well, I'm now living in heaven, and I'm living a spiritual existence, and I've left behind all this terrible physicality now. But instead, he stands there and eats fish in front of them, and he even goes fishing with them, and he's too physical, he's too real, he's too part of the dirt and reality of this world. It isn't a story that Jews can accept, or Greeks or Romans. I wouldn't invent it that way.
Now, you're saying then that the kind of doctrine, like, say, the Jehovah's Witnesses have, which is a spiritual resurrection, would have been much more acceptable back then.
Oh, you could sell that. You see it in the way in which Paul is writing in 1 Corinthians 15, you know, the longest chapter in the New Testament, because he's trying to convince them, yes, it's believable that Jesus would rise physically. You know, he still goes through all these arguments about a seed dies and then it comes back, it comes as a new body, and in the Old Testament you've got talks about a new body. Surely it is believable, isn't it? And you can see he's eating his heart out, trying to get them to accept this. But there are people in Corinth who are saying, no, we only believe in a spiritual resurrection. There's no way it could be physical. We can't believe that. That goes too far. Even Christians were having problems with it, let alone the non-Christians. And I'm sure that the church would have grown far faster without this difficulty of a physical resurrection.
Now, since you brought up 1 Corinthians 15, there is a lot of talk amongst the people out there who say that Paul was in fact saying the resurrection was spiritual in 1 Corinthians 15. For instance, he never mentions an empty tomb. He refers to Jesus as becoming a life-giving spirit, and he talks about a spiritual body. So I think it's important that we deal with those kinds of charges before we go on. So what's Paul really saying by those things?
He's trying to make the physical resurrection as acceptable as possible to these Gentile Christians who just can't accept it. So he says, well, look, it's like a seed, you know, a physical seed. When it grows, it turns into a physical plant. You turn into something different, but it's still physical. And it's when Jesus rose, yes, he was physical, but it's a spiritual being. You know, he was better than human. And he's trying to get them to accept this, but it's very difficult for him because he's really trying to sell them a story which they don't want to hear. And I know when you hear me say that, it sounds as if I don't believe in the resurrection. Because the only reason I can see why the gospel writers would have such a ridiculous story in there is because they couldn't avoid it. People knew that there were these tales about Jesus appearing. They knew that there was this claim that he'd risen physically, and they had to do something with it. And the only thing they could do is to put it forward as fallibly as well as possible. Even the story about the soldiers there, you know, discovering the saying that people had stolen the corpse away. That's believable, you know, that someone had stolen the corpse. Still, of course, you know that the soldiers, they would have been killed for their lapse of duty. So many strange things going on, and the only reason I can see that they would record it in this way is because something like this did actually happen.
Well, I don't doubt you believe in resurrection, and I just know you're presenting the case for way Paul would have done that. This would have been seen as unbelievable. And one other aspect we should mention this is that for the people in the Greek world, their mindset, being in a body was not seen as a good thing.
Yeah, it's that they're different Greek mindsets. You know, there were the Stoics, Epicureans, and there's the ordinary people, and there's lots of different religions, and they didn't all reject the physical body and regard the physical body as being bad, but some of them certainly did, and some parts of Christianity, of course, later did. But the idea of someone finally coming back to life and then, oh, he's just human, is he? It's a real letdown. You know, you should come back as a god. You should come back big and bronzed and powerful and doing even more miracles than before. And what's he doing? He comes back and cooks breakfast.
Uh-huh.
So mundane. You wouldn't make it up.
Or even just coming back and kind of being saying, like, going back to the Jews and the Roman Empire and saying, I'm back and I'm not going to take it anymore, and just laying waste to all of them.
Yeah, go and show yourself in the cloud as a huge 200-foot Jesus and say, see, I told you so.
And for those curious,
and he walks around in the same little Galilee that he was in before and sort of just appears to just a few people. And come on, let's have a good story at least. But I find it fascinating, this inscription, the Nazareth inscription. Do you know it's the one that's in the Bibliothèque Nationale in France? If it was in the British Museum.
If it was
in the British Museum, everyone would know about it. But it's the one that says that graves and tombs must remain undisturbed.
Saying? It's that if anyone's found guilty of raiding a tomb, they get the death penalty.
Yes. And a very strange inscription. It's supposedly in the name of Caesar. And it's a large bit of marble. It's a 2-foot square piece of marble. Probably from the mid-first century, maybe from the late-first century. And it says that these graves and tombs must remain undisturbed, because otherwise, as you say, they suffer death. Well, why? the Romans weren't buried in tombs, but they had urns of ashes. So this is protecting Jewish tombs. And it says, especially if you've moved a sepulchre sealing stone, you know, these stones which were put in front of tombs, if you move that, you can suffer capital punishment. Why were the Romans so bothered about people breaking into Jewish tombs? And they're not bothered about people stealing grave goods, you know, stealing valuables. It says, and if you take the body that's been buried to another place, it's not stealing grave goods, it's stealing the actual corpses that they're being punished for. What's the big deal? And the only reason I can think of is, we don't want anything like Christianity starting again. That started just from someone stealing a body, or at least the body disappeared. Let's do something to make sure that never happens again. That was a big one.
Yeah, it looks like we've got someone who's willing to call in here, so I'm going to put them on the line and see if they've got a good question here. So, Carlo, you're on the air with Dr. Enstone Brewer.
I am?
Yeah.
Hello? Okay. Hello. My question was, what made the physical resurrection so dishonorable? Was it because it was so mundane, or was it because there were still flesh wounds?
It's not that resurrection is dishonorable. And I'd quite like to have been there and seen it, and that would have been an honourable thing. But it's a difficult thing to sell to someone, to say, this person was dead, and now he's alive. It was one of the things that all Jews and, that all Greeks and Romans agreed about. Once you're dead, you're dead. Your corpse is gone. You burn the corpse because it's of no use to anyone. It's just rubbish. You might keep the ashes in a nice place, but no one ever comes back to life. They had a saying, the blood flows into the ground and it's gone. So to claim that someone raised from the dead immediately makes your religion unbelievable. And if you are a Christian trying to convince a Greek or Roman about Jesus, it's best just not to mention the resurrection. That's not going to win you any points at all. It's certainly not going to get you a convert.
Thank you very much. I think that answers my question.
Hey, thank you for calling in. Now, to be clear, of course, we are still affirming everything here. I don't want people to get the wrong idea. Yeah, we do uphold the virgin birth or resurrection, things. That's what we were just saying. This is honestly the way it would have been seen at the time. We're not saying it's bad. We're not making any moral judgment or such. We're saying this is just the way people saw it. And if you were making up a religion, you would not make up a religion like Christianity.
If you did, it would get nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason it got somewhere is that God was behind it and still powerful and still showing himself real among these converts. And they were able to stand up against all the prejudice and say, well, I know it sounds stupid, but it's real to me, and I'm going to stand by it, and you can kill me if you like, I'm still going to be a Christian.
Yeah, and you've said that there were some quote-unquote forms of Christianity that did try to spiritualize things, such as the Gnostics. And the Gnostics, before a crowd, if a Christian and a Gnostic was making a presentation, the crowd would be much more appealed to the Gnostic presentation of Jesus than the Christian one. Is that correct?
Yeah, and the Gnostic Christianity was probably quite large. It's difficult to know because, of course, it didn't continue, and so people didn't keep copying their manuscripts. But, you know, we have the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Judas and these strange things turning up now and then. And they turn up in the very dry sands of Egypt, where they managed to survive. But presumably that sort of teaching was quite widespread and popular because it zeroed into what people wanted to believe. The four Gospels we have are very difficult for people at the time to believe, very difficult to accept, and these other versions were much easier. So they would have been quite popular.
Yeah, but I can hear a skeptic saying, Dr. Enstone Brewer, strange beliefs win all the time. They become very popular. Mithraism had a lot of strange beliefs. Mormonism, that has a lot of strange beliefs, and both of those were quite popular. Mormonism is a very large church here in America, and Ernst Renan, I think, even said that if Christianity had been around, we'd probably all be Mithraists today. Is there any difference between what Mormons and Mithraists were saying versus what Christians were saying? And for the Mormons, you can say, is there anything different about society Mormonism grew up in rather than society that Christianity arose in?
I know very little about Mormonism. It's on the other side of the Atlantic, and there are very few adherents on this side. I think because we're more intelligent, but I'll put that to one side. But with Mithraism, it's very difficult to know exactly what they believe, because, of course, they kept their cult secrets, and we have some artifacts left over. We have sort of these Mithraim in dungeons or in basements, and we know they sort of poured blood over initiates and did horrible things like that, and kept their secrets and their little... I regard them rather like the... here we have the Masons, and you have the Buffalo things, and you know the groups where you do horrible things to make the membership seem special, and then you always back each other up, and this group defends each other, and it's a sort of nice feeling of togetherness, and you know we're going to stand with each other rather like an army platoon who defend each other against terrible, terrible odds, because they've got such camaraderie together. And I don't know if they really believed the stuff about Mithras and that. It's just, you know, do the Masons really believe the curses they say to each other when they say don't really reveal these secrets? I think it's a sort of club thing, and it's, you know, so you've got this religious element, so that's what we go through in order to join the club.
But Christianity would not have really been like that, would it?
Well, Christianity, you don't join that in order to get better in life. First of all, it's not a secret thing, although you'd probably prefer that your neighbors didn't know that you were a Christian. And you don't get any great benefits. In fact, you're thrown out of your normal associations, so you don't get the normal benefits that you have as a member of society. And you lose everything by becoming a Christian. So then you really have to believe what it is that's setting you apart, because you've got no other motive for joining except that that's true. And if it's not true, then, as Paul says in Corinthians, we're the most unfortunate of people, because we lost everything and for nothing.
We recently had come on the History Channel, the Bible miniseries, and after that there was a show called Vikings that comes on, and my wife likes to watch that, so I watch it with her. And last time they had a Viking agree to be baptized, and what I noticed was that immediately afterwards, all of his comrades were just looking at him differently and making statements like, "You've betrayed the gods," and things of that sort. And you know, We found it kind of amusing, but at the same time, I was thinking, that's exactly what it would have been like at the time of Jesus. To become a Christian would have been seen as betraying your heritage, the deities, or Yahweh in the case of Jews. Any number of things like that, it would have been seen as a worse shame to become a Christian.
Yeah, and we see that when it wasn't such a shameful thing, you know, in the 3rd century when Constantine became a Christian and it became an official religion, that's when the church went wrong and started becoming corrupt, and the wrong people wanted to become Christians, and everything went screwy. Christianity was born at a time when you had to give up everything to be a Christian, and so those folks then, they were so brave, and we aspire to be like them.
In fact, when we read the book of Hebrews, we are told in, I think, the 10th chapter that you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood, which means these people were being persecuted, but their persecution wasn't yet coming from bloodshed or violent threats. It was from ostracizing and shame and mockery.
Yeah, it's more than that. It was a very paranoid political climate. If you met with some friends, it was assumed that you were meeting to plot against the emperor. So any meeting of people had to be an official meeting. You had to be part of an official association or part of an official religion. And Jews, of course, they had a dispensation to meet because Julius Caesar had said, yes, you're an ancient religion, you are allowed to meet on the Sabbath and you're allowed to have your religious meetings. But Christians weren't an official religion. So if you, the Hebrews was written to Jews who had converted to Christianity, as soon as you gave up your Judaism and said, and we're still going to meet together, well, that's illegal. It is actually illegal for them to meet together because it's assumed that you're being political activists. And if anyone reported them, then they could be arrested. You could keep their property as your reward for reporting them. It was a terrible curse. And, of course, it would be much easier for them to go back to being Jews and then they could meet legally. And so, yeah, it's very, very difficult times.
And something else to bring up, based on what you said, Judaism got an exception because they were an ancient religion. Christianity was new, and for the Romans, new was not good.
It's not just that new is not good. I mean, there were sort of new religions. No, yeah, you're right. Yeah, new religions were looked down on. But that wasn't entirely the thing. I think Jews were very fortunate in having this deal with Julius Caesar. But they still had to go to go and talk to the emperor. Philo went off to talk to the emperor to remind him of this deal that they had with Julius Caesar, that they were allowed to meet. And that was good. And I think Paul would have liked to have done the same thing if he'd ever got round to meeting the emperor, to get Christianity recognized as an official religion. But it was very difficult for Christians. They just were not allowed to meet together.
Okay, we're here with Dr. David Enstone Brewer. When we come back, I'd like us to talk about women in the church and how they are today and how they would have been seen in the time of Jesus. I'm Nick Peters for Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Join Army Girl for Christ and Minister Grock as they tackle some of today's pressing issues from a Christian point of view on Truth Be Told, every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, check out cyiworldwide.com.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You could send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
We are here with Dr. David Enstone Brewer, author of The Jesus Scandals. I'm your host, Nick Peters. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. Let's talk about women with Jesus, son. What was so scandalous about women and Jesus?
There's nothing wrong with women when they're in the kitchen and when they're looking after the men and when they're doing good things like having babies. But having women following Jesus around, that was a very strange thing. As far as we know, Jesus was the only rabbi who had women in his entourage. And especially when you get people like Mary and Martha, the two sisters, where Mary was actually sitting at Jesus' feet along with the other disciples, listening to him. Oh, good grief, what are you doing there? You should be... It wasn't just Martha who actually spoke the words, you should be helping me with the cooking. Everyone would have been glaring at her and saying, what is in their heads, you know, what on earth is she doing here? She got lost somewhere on the way to the scullery. Women didn't do that sort of thing.
So the joke that you can often hear today about women needing to be barefoot and pregnant, that would have been the modern worldview of a time. In fact, it would have been the worldview held by women back then, right?
Yes, it wasn't the normal Jewish way that you find in the Old Testament, but by the New Testament times, that this is the morality which had been imposed on Judaism by the rest of the world. And yeah, the women were very submissive in all sorts of ways.
But everything that Jesus did, from the talks with a Samaritan woman to anything else, Mary and Martha... He uplifted women constantly.
Yeah, it's strange, especially in Luke, where you have these women who are going round with him, with the disciples, And it even says that there were women who were his main supporters. They were helping him financially. That sort of thing happened, but you don't normally talk about it. It's it's a bit embarrassing to have women being your main supporters. And of course, when you've got people like Mary Magdalene, who I guess people would have called Mad Mary, who had all these demons in her, and she would have been the woman that you shoo away from your house and hope your children don't meet, and then have her as such an important person among in Jesus' entourage, it means that you might even warn your children about Jesus, because he has such strange companions.
And could even have rumors been going around that Jesus would have even been possibly having an affair with some of these women?
Well, Jews were very careful not to spend any time alone with a woman, because so that morally compromised them. If you were alone with a woman for more than a few minutes, it was assumed that she was now morally compromised and couldn't marry, because obviously you must have had sex. It's a strange society where you had to be careful of women, and that there's people used to keep their heads down so they wouldn't look at women. It's almost like they were afraid of them. But you don't see that in Jesus at all. In Jesus, even when a prostitute walks into a room and starts massaging his feet, he lets her, because she realizes that she's trying to repent this way. He just had a completely different attitude.
It's amusing to me here in America that we can see a number of people who are feminists. Not all of them are this way, but many who are complaining about Christianity. And when I see that, I keep thinking, if it wasn't for Christianity, you might not even have the ability to complain, because Jesus was the one who made that men and women are seen as practically equal.
Yes. Equal in in practice, no.
Yes.
There was only so much Jesus could do. You still end up with a world where women don't inherit, women don't have real power, women have no legal authority in the courts. He couldn't change the world, but he could show by his attitude to women that he respected them as equals.
Yeah. And that can also get us into what Jesus said about marriage. It was pretty severe for the time, wasn't it?
You mean that you should not get divorced?
Yes.
Is that marriage?
Yes.
Yeah. In that in Jesus' day, you could get divorced for anything, but it was only the man who could ask for that divorce. I'm sort of reading back into Jesus' day the situation that was after his day, but that was what was becoming the norm. And most divorces were the divorces which the men decided on. A few decades before Jesus, women were still able to get divorces.
Yeah. And if I'm correct, there were two schools at the time, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel. And I think it was Shammai that was the hardest one, that said it had to be adultery for divorce, and the school of Hillel said if your wife burnt your toast in the morning, you could get a divorce.
Not really. First of all, there were lots of schools. Hillel and Shammai were the ones that we know most about, because we have a document which compares and contrasts them in 200 different issues. The other schools have disappeared into the morass of history, and we don't know anything about them. But no, both Hillel and Shammai accepted that you could get a divorce for virtually anything. But I'm sorry. No. You are right. Sorry. I'm getting myself. But Hillel invented this divorce for anything, and Shammai said, no. In Deuteronomy, it is divorce for adultery. Yes, I'm sorry.
We should
listening to me.
We should explain. It's probably about 9:30 p.m. over in England, so it's getting awfully late. when we go over to the New Testament, it seems some people even think that Paul is trying to soften things a bit, such as in 1 Corinthians 7, where he says that if the unbelieving spouse walks out, well, you can let them walk out.
Yeah, he's able to do that because in the Old Testament you can have a divorce not just for adultery, but also for abandonment. In Exodus 21:10, you have the right of a slave wife for a divorce if her food or her clothing or her conjugal rights are lessened, are less than they have been. And in other words, if she's abandoned, she can have a divorce. And people said, well, if a slave wife can have that right, then surely a free wife also has that right. And of course, if a woman has that right, a man has that right. So Paul is saying, in effect, well, if you're being abandoned by this non-believer, then that's a divorce on biblical grounds, and you can be divorced for that. But he completely rejects the Hillelite divorce for any reason at all. He says, you know, if there's this woman at the beginning of 1 Corinthians 7 who's walked out on her husband. In other words, in Roman terms, she's divorced him. And he tells her, no, you've got to go back. You have no reason for that divorce. You have to go back and try and be reconciled with him, because he, like Jesus, completely rejects divorce for no fault at all.
Now, why would this have been seen as scandalous in Jesus' day, his teaching on marriage?
Well, the disciples don't like it at all, because it means once they're married, they have to stay married. You can't get divorced just because your wife starts getting wrinkles or burns a dinner, as Hillel would have it. You can't get divorced when you get fed up with it. You have to stay married, because even if you do something wrong, even if you commit adultery, it's not your choice whether you get divorced or not. It's her choice. She decides, okay, that's one adultery too many. You know, I've forgiven 50 of these adulteries already. He's clearly never going to repent. Then I choose to divorce him. But the man can't choose to divorce just unless she really does something terrible. And the disciples said, well, in that case, who's going to get married? And I think Jesus would say, though he wasn't so rude, well, if your attitude is like that, perhaps you shouldn't marry. You know, marriage is for life. Marriage is something you make promises to.
Yeah. Now, to be clear, it does talk about adultery, but in some cases that's usually read as unfaithfulness. What if I say, Dave, for instance, someone's asking, well, okay, you can have a divorce if someone's adulterous, but what if you've got a case such as an abusive husband or something like that? Would that fall under the paradigm as well?
Abuse is the extreme version of neglect. You know, the way in which it's described in the Old Testament in Exodus is neglect of food and clothing and the conjugal rights. But of course, once you're starting hitting people, that's gone way beyond neglect. That's gone way into the red zone. And certainly, yes, you have the rights to divorce there. And I'm saying these things very glibly and very quickly. I've written a great deal on divorce and remarriage. And you can go to divorceremarriage.com and see many, many arguments. And you'll see that although this sounds very strange, perhaps, to many of your listeners, it is very biblically based. And this explains the teaching of Jesus and the strange apparent contradictions between Jesus and Paul, who certainly are not contradicting each other. They are both saying the same thing, that you must have biblical grounds for divorce. And a divorce cannot happen unless there are those biblical grounds.
Yeah. And to be clear, of course, for all listeners out there who might be getting any kind of concern, I think we're both saying, of course, that divorce should be seen as the last resort, as it were. And it's certainly nothing glorifying, and no one's trying to make divorce something easy to bring about. Is that correct?
Absolutely. But I must also emphasize that the fact that you're divorced does not mean shame on yourself. The shame comes on the person who caused that divorce, the person who broke their marriage vows. So in the Old Testament, even God is seen as a divorcee. God is had to divorce Israel for her adulteries. And this doesn't bring shame on God, but it certainly is. He is very unhappy about it. So in Malachi, he says he hates divorce. And, someone who's been through it knows how he feels. It's a terrible, terrible thing to go through. And God is clearly a victim of that divorce rather than the perpetrator of it.
Now, when we go to Paul, since you've said you don't think he contradicts Jesus, and I agree with that, when we read Ephesians 5, for instance,
you said that a bit too quickly. Let's say it a bit slower. Paul appears to contradict Jesus, and he doesn't. That's what you mean, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I do sometimes speak fast. I'm saying that sometimes people think Paul contradicts Jesus on a surface level, but when one gets down to the nitty-gritty, they're in total agreement. They're just saying things differently. You're addressing different situations.
Both Jesus mm-hmm. and Paul are saying this yeah. divorce for no cause at all. In the Jewish world, it was called the any-cause divorce. In the Roman world, it was divorce by separation, where you just walk out, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. was your divorce. They both reject that completely and will only accept divorce on biblical grounds.
Okay. Now, having said, when we go to Ephesians 5, and I'm pretty sure this was a passage that was even read at mine and Ari's wedding, and I'm sure it's read at many weddings, and it's got in there the line, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church." And honestly, most of the guys in the audience who have been listening to that letter being read would have thought, what is Paul smoking right now? Right?
You mean because... I don't think I understand that question.
And the idea of husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church, it was really something new back then. It was something seen as extreme because a wife wasn't seen that way. A wife was just someone who took care of a house and gave you babies. Wasn't necessarily supposed to be the object of love and affection.
Oh, I think we can be down on the ancient world a bit too much. I'm sure there were many Roman couples where there was very great love and big couples and Jewish couples. Mm-hmm. But obviously there were also couples where the husband just spent as little time as possible at home and spent all his time with mistresses, and which he was allowed to do. But we don't have to blacken the whole of their society. Okay. But I suppose the surprising thing there is where Paul says, as with all moralists of the time, that the wife should submit to her husband. He also says submit to each other, which would really make the audience sit up and say, hey, hang on, didn't you get that wrong there? You meant she should submit to me, don't you? No, he says submit to each other.
Yeah, my ministry partner has said for him the secret to his years of marriage has been two words, mutual submission.
Yes, it's what you used to have in the Old Testament, but from the time of Esther, things changed completely. You have there in Esther, you have that great phrase, the man should be the master in the household. Mm-hmm. Which everyone thinks, oh, that's Christian teaching. Well, no, that's what the Persian emperor said. You know, a man should be master in his house. And that's what Esther was fighting against and what Judaism didn't have. But in the end, it became the center of Roman and Greek morality. And so Josephus and Philo end up teaching this thing. Look, we've got to go along with this because we're going to be thought to be immoral if we don't. And Peter and Paul, they both say, well, we've got to do this as well, so that the gospel isn't slandered. Because it's recognized as the way in which you work society, that the woman is submissive to the man. And unfortunately, in some parts of Christianity, we still have that.
You know, I've written on this on my blog, which, for anyone interested, that's deeperwaters.wordpress.com, because we've got the marriage debates going on here today in America and in other places where people want to redefine marriage, and I've even heard that debate on Unbelievable a few times. And what I've said is that the reason the world is wanting to dishonor marriage is sadly the church has done it first, that we really haven't followed the teachings of Christ on marriage, and if we don't honor marriage, why should we expect the rest of the world to do so?
I can understand why people do this, because they see in the New Testament, wives submit to your husbands, children submit to your father, slaves submit to your master. But they don't see the quotation marks that they would have seen in the first century, because those were all quotations from Aristotle's Economics, which was repeated in the they were repeated in the commentaries on Aristotle's work in the first century and repeated in Josephus and Philo. These were quotations. And then Paul and Peter, they say, but husbands, respect your wives and love her sacrificially like Jesus. Fathers, children, submit to your fathers, but fathers, don't exasperate your children. And it says, slaves should submit to their masters, but Christians have to treat their slaves as if they are fellow believers almost. So there's quotation marks around those submission phrases, and then the Christian commentary added onto it. And instead of listening to the Christian commentary, which says, but, we take those quotes from Aristotle as if they're Christian teaching, and they never were.
Well, we're going to take our last break. When we come back, since it's Autism Awareness Month, we'll be talking about Jesus and the Disabled and talking a little bit about the Asperger's community at Cambridge. We will be back in a little bit.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
We're back with Dr. David Enstone Brewer here of the Deeper Waters podcast. And Dr. Enstone Brewer, we're going to be talking about the disabled community for Autism Awareness Month here. At the start, what can you tell me about how Jesus saw the disabled in comparison to how people of his time saw the disabled?
Well, of course, in Jesus' time, if you were disabled, you were born with a condition or some sort of condition came to you, some sort of madness or some sort of disability, it was your fault. It was sinful. Sin had caused it. You were cursed by God for this. And there's no way around that. That's obviously what had happened. So I didn't recognize autism as a separate thing then, but they would have seen that as something which had come on them through some sin. Maybe an evil spirit was causing it, or maybe not. But they did recognize that they were madnesses which weren't caused by evil spirits. But any sort of disability, any sort of illness was caused by sin. But they had this nice long list, if you had a respiratory illness such as asthma, that was caused by slandering someone, or perhaps due to neglecting to pay your tithes. Or if you had edema, that's high blood pressure normally causes that. That was due to your sort of sin in general, is a very common thing, of course. And jaundice, that was due to hating someone without reason. they sort of see your illness and diagnose your sin rather than diagnosing how to help you.
Now, right now, you're on a podcast that's hosted by someone on the spectrum, and my wife is on the spectrum, but if this kind of technology had been around in the time of Jesus, what I'm doing right now would have never happened, most likely, would it?
Well, you wouldn't have had help in communicating, and there wouldn't have been any understanding during education to get the maximum potential out of people. Of course, in Cambridge, there's lots of people with autism, of all strains of autism, right from the terrible, debilitating, to the sort of lack of communication and the straight line thinking and concrete thinking. Because we have so many clever people here, so many professors who are able at one end of the spectrum of autism to concentrate so carefully on a particular subject, they become an expert. An expert, of course, is someone who knows more and more about something while knowing less and less about everything else. Because we have such a high concentration of these very clever people who are on one end of the spectrum of autism, we have quite a large community of people who are born with autistic problems. And it's kind of normal here and acceptable.
Someone put an image on my Facebook one time, or heck, I'm out sharing with someone. I saw it kind of describe a situation where, with for those of us on the spectrum, it's like a light switch. If it's in the off position, it's no interest at all. If it's in the on position, it's totally obsessed. There's no in between.
Oh, no, that's absolutely wrong. No, the whole point of the spectrum is that there's everything in between. And there are many people who have aspects of autism, and of course there are many different sorts of autism, so hey, I don't know much about it. Of course, we have the world expert here. We have Professor Simon Baron Cohen, who has done a great deal to be able to identify different sorts of autism and how to help them. You probably know Sacha Baron Cohen, the actor.
Borat,
that's it, yes. Well, this is his cousin. His cousin is a professor of autism at Cambridge University.
Yeah, that's... I was going to make sure to ask about that. It's a very unusual connection to have, but this community of Ashby's and people on the spectrum, they are very valued over at Cambridge for all their many contributions that they make.
Yes, because they often have a bigger understanding of a particular area than anyone else could ever get, because they're able to concentrate so carefully on that. But I find it interesting. I was trying to think, was there anyone in the Gospels who had any autistic tendencies? I'm throwing this out as a joke now, I suppose. What about Nicodemus? See, he came at night because he didn't want to meet people and had difficulty with face-to-face contact. And he's obviously a sort of detailed person who liked rules and needed rules, because he was a Pharisee, so he sort of worked very much within a rule mindset. And he had this concrete way of thinking, so when Jesus said you've got to be born again, he said, oh, you mean go back into my mother's womb, which of course he didn't mean. He didn't have this metaphorical sense of thinking at all. But maybe. Jesus was happy to meet with him where he was and talk to him and explain things to him. And I think if Jesus had met someone who was really suffered from autism, they would have found a friend.
Yeah, I've done that same thing looking back at history. I've thought, for instance, when I was in seminary, Thomas Aquinas was someone we very cited, and I'd look at some of the things that he did, such as going to a party and he'd be lost and far, and then all of a sudden he'd slam his fist down and say, and that we're set over manichees. And I'd look at him and think, yeah, it sounds like someone on the spectrum to me. But you're saying you're saying that someone on the spectrum would have found a friend in Jesus. Why is that?
I think so, yes. I think so.
But why?
Oh, because Jesus was the one who accepted people on the outside. He was the one who went and talked to people that no one else would talk to. You know, he just ignored all the normal conventions of staying away from the strange people and went and sought them out. And he was that sort of person. So the person who's even at the extreme of banging his head on the wall because he can't face the world, Jesus would have been there putting an arm around him. Or maybe not putting an arm around him, because that would have been even more difficult. But talking quietly.
But when we see Jesus, he's also healing people a lot. Some people say, well, he's healing them because he thinks there's something evil about their condition inherently. And that's not necessarily the case. I mean, there can be downsides to some conditions, but like you've already said, there can be upsides to them as well. So what would it mean if Jesus healed someone like that?
There are people who stand up for the rights of the blind and say, being blind is not a disability, it is just the way I am, and I would not want to be any different. And that they, even to the extreme of not helping their children to get the maximum sight that they can get. I can see that you should stand up for the rights of people who have disabilities, but to deny that it is a disability is very strange to me. But along with the disabilities often do come extra abilities, and I think that's so with autism, that when the condition is not so bad, then you do have some great abilities. I remember one guy I used to meet regularly in an institution where he was. He was unfortunately born at a time when if you had autism, you went straight into a long-term institution, and so he wasn't living in society. There wasn't any way he could now live in society. But we used to have these services there, and he didn't know the tunes that we wanted to play, but you just start singing them, and he'd start playing, put all the chords in, and just play along. He could figure out what you're trying to do, and he was able to play whatever he wanted, but he was blind as well as autistic, and yet he just could do whatever he wanted with a piano. And of course, he was also one of these guys that has the facility with dates. You know, he did the sort of party game. You tell me what date you were born on, and I'll tell you what day of the week it was. I don't know how they do that, but it seems to be a sort of common thing that's been made famous in that film with Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah,
did this anyway, and it's a nice party trick, and it's the only way he could socialize, really, by doing that.
It's so ironic that you mentioned that, because if my wife and I are out in public and I hear someone mention their birthday, I'll look at my wife and I'll say, "You know what I'm doing, don't you?" She says, "Yes, I know what you're doing." And my father-in-law likes to... It's kind of, you have to know how many days are in each month of the calendar first off, and you start off from days that you do know. Like, I start with my birthday, and my dad's birthday is in May, so on the same day of the week. I have another friend whose birthday is in July, so on the same day of the week. And you follow some rules, like the calendar repeats itself every 28 years, and go forward one day for 1 year, making exceptions for leap years. It sounds complicated, but it's very nice.
How long does it take you?
Usually I get it done in under 10 seconds.
Okay, well, that sounds pretty slow compared to this guy.
Yeah,
10 seconds is fantastically impressive as far as I'm concerned, but it would take me a week to do it. This guy just did it. Oh, well, it was Tuesday.
When we get together with my in-laws and we'll play a card game like Uno and such, when it comes time for the score, they'll come in and say, how many points do each one have? Okay, how do you add them up? Okay, and they know that I'll do the math very well. My father-in-law is very interested in, has jokingly said a few times, "Yeah, you need to learn how to count cards and I can take you to Vegas."
You're
right. It is a way to socialize. It's something that I use when I'm with people to try to be an icebreaker, because believe it or not, going up and talking about Christian apologetics just usually doesn't do that for people.
Yeah, I guess.
Now, you've said that in Jesus' day, the disabled would have been seen as a scandal, as it were. Today, as we can tell, it's totally different. I mean, if you'd been a teacher back in Jesus' day, you probably wouldn't have interacted with me at all. But here today, we're interacting and we're doing just fine. So what's changed in this time that the disabled are no longer rejected, but in fact, we have charities just for the disabled? What's made the difference?
I think I would have to say it is Christianity, because if you look in former communist Russia and in communist China, or places like Romania, where it is still the case that if you have a disabled child, you are so ashamed by that disability that you give that child into the state orphanage. And these state orphanages have children whose parents are alive, it's just that the parents refuse to treat them. I've spoken with someone who works in Russia trying to get parents of disabled children to keep those children. And it's almost impossible. They are so ashamed that they would have a disabled child that they don't even tell their neighbors they've had a child, and they try and get rid of it to the state orphanage. And it's the non-Christian society that they still inherited, the norms of that society, as far as I can see. Whereas here, although we're in a sort of post-Christian society, we've still got that morality that everyone is important, even if they're disabled, even if they can't think for themselves, even if they're so ill they can't move. Their life itself is important. It's a Christian concept which has embedded itself in our society, and it's a fantastic boon to us.
Yeah, for those interested, next week, in fact, I'll be interviewing Megan Arman of the Life Training Institute, and part of what we'll be talking about is disability and abortion. We've got a few minutes left. You are talking about a sort of background Christian knowledge that everyone has, and this is a point I bring up even when I'm debating atheists, that they make so many statements about morality, and I'm saying the only reason you're making those statements is because there's a background Christianity that's affected your thinking, and you don't even realize it.
Yeah, I don't want to diss the people who are morally, living morally without being Christians. I think that's a fantastic mm-hmm. thing to do, because they have no motive. You know, they're not trying to get to heaven. They're not trying to please God. They're living morally because they feel that's the right thing to do, and that is wonderful. But yes, I think they should recognize where they're getting those morals from. Really, the fact that Hitler did experiments on criminals mm-hmm. and on disabled people, the fact that we recognize that's wrong isn't because there's something unpragmatic about it, that it does harm to people. It's just wrong. And how mm-hmm. do you explain it's wrong? In the end, it's because those people are valuable in God's eyes.
Mm-hmm. But the church still needs to learn this in many areas. I mean, there are churches that do just fine. There are some that can still have difficulty. What message do you think we should get to the church about the disabled community today, and how do you think the church could maybe do things differently to show the love of Christ to those who are disabled?
I don't think the church is doing that badly, is it?
Mm-hmm.
The church does look after disabled people, regard them mm-hmm. as special people.
Mm-hmm.
I think on this side of the Atlantic, we're not very good at mm-hmm. church services, because our church services are rather cerebral, which means mm-hmm. that people who sort of from lower educational levels don't tend to attend church very much. It's rather the opposite in America. But I don't think we're bad at looking after disabled people, are we? Or put me right.
Okay, well, maybe I'm saying, I wouldn't say we're bad, but I would say sometimes we could be a bit more sensitive. And for instance, I can get very nervous in a church service with where it pretty much becomes a social club a lot of times, where you have to go forward and shake everyone's hand and such. And you just have to realize that not everyone's going to handle things the same way. And there are some people that might respond, some people in the spectrum might respond to loud music differently than anyone else, or repetition or anything like that. So the church is good, but we also always have to remember that we need to be sensitive that people are different, and no, we don't have to change everything in the church for them, but we should realize that they're different. And usually if someone on the spectrum, the downside that you have is if someone comes in and say a wheelchair, no one's going to challenge them to a foot race. But the condition of being on the spectrum is invisible, and when you don't socialize with everyone else, people can think, oh my gosh, are you rude? Are you some kind of jerk or something? It's like, no, I just don't do that kind of thing, don't know how to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, those are things that I hadn't really considered properly, but it sounds like you'd be much happier in the UK, because here we don't hug. You know, here we have something called British Reserve, and you'd feel much happier.
Mm-hmm. Overall, though, the basic thing we can get about this is, from your book, there is so much historical about Jesus, and we know this because Jesus was seen as a scandal time, and just as he is today.
Yep, this is a historian's look at the gospel, saying these bits you just got to accept, whether you accept that Jesus is Lord or not. These are the historical bits, and it's amazing what is there that you can't deny. So go to BibleScandals.com, and you'll see the beginning of every chapter and lots of freebies.
Mm-hmm. And you can get this book on Amazon as well, and I'm sure most any fine bookstore you could get it. And where can people go to find out more about you?
Again, if you go to BibleScandals.com, then you'll find links to me and other things I've written, and you'll find more information than even my mother knew.
Okay. Dr. Enstone Brewer, I know it's been late over there in the UK, but I thank you for taking your time to be with us, and it sounds like I've heard you talking to your missus over there, and I definitely appreciate her being supportive of you in this, and Now, you do it. Thank you for being my guest on the Deeper Waters podcast, and I hope we'll see you back here again sometime.
Great. Thanks, Nick. Thanks for talking. Bye.
No problem. Bye. And, well, that's been our episode today of the Deeper Waters podcast. Next week, we will have Megan Allman talking about abortion and how Christians can give a pro-life answer. Until then, I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters podcast, and I am signing off.